founder of Capitalist Exploits. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
It's good to be back, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too, Chris. You know, it seems that when we look around nowadays, there's nothing but seemingly straws ready to break the camel's back here, from the bond market to Japan's market interventions, the AI bubble, or more war and more threats from one country to another. And this space has been talking about many of these issues for a really long time as being, you know, imminent issues that are going to break the markets, break out in more active war, whatever it is. I want to kind of like reframe how we've been thinking about that and look at it from the other way. How do you think things have stayed together this long?
It's a good question, and it's one that I got wrong for some time to a certain degree, insofar as, you know, you and I could have had a conversation. In fact, we did back in Buenos Aires roughly over a year ago, where pretty much the same is true. And you saw things being completely out of sync, and have managed to continue to remain out of sync, and to a degree now where they're even more out of sync. And so the answer to that particular question specifically lies in the ability for the manipulation of the financial markets. And I don't mean that necessarily as in going and buying futures and mispricing an asset or affecting it. And there's some of that taking place, but that's not what I'm referring to. I'm just referring to the fact that the vast majority of the world operates on a dollar standard and on a dollar-based credit system. And there is an ability to manipulate the credit because there's an ability to manipulate the front end of the curve on the treasury yields. And that affects all asset prices, equities, bonds, private equity, you name it. And so, and it is a phenomenal power to be able to wield that power. Like any phenomenal power or weapon, it is being used to its full extent now, to the point where its usefulness, I think, and this is back to the reference you made to Japan, is coming to an end. Its ability to actually influence markets to the degree that it has in the past is coming under pressure. So where we have, for example, the AI bubble, there's actually three bubbles that are all significant and they're all tied into one pivotal structural component. And that component is basically interest rates. So those three bubbles, you got the credit bubble, private credit bubble. We can talk about that briefly. We've written about it extensively. You've got the AI Mag 7 equity bubble. And then the big daddy, which is the sovereign debt bubble, is the one where the pricing of that risk affects all the others. So if you think about interest rates, which is the sovereign debt bubble, and we're just now watching this, right? So the 30 years blowing out on the US, German bunds, 30 years are blown out. So the reason I'm pointing to the 30 year and even the 10 year is because there is an ability by central banks to manipulate the front end of the curve much more easily than the long end. So the long end is what matters. That's the direction of travel. If we've pulled up the Japanese government bond yields, the same issue is true there, especially on the long end. And that's a market which is wholly owned. Like the Japanese government bond market is not even a market. It's not even really traded. That's the pivotal thing that ties back into, say, private credit. So on the private credit side of things, and by the way, this is much, much larger than it has ever been before. And it's not a topic that gets talked about a lot, but it really does matter. You've got layered leverage on private credit to the extent where you're running up to 20 times leverage on this on what are illiquid assets, okay? Those illiquid assets And this is where it's important for your readers, I guess. In the past, private credit, private equity was the realm of wealthy, either institutional or ultra high net worth individuals that could be participating in that space, right? There was a rule change that took place under the Trump administration, which basically said, oh, you know, we're going to make things really great for everybody. We're going to allow individuals to be owning private equity. So there was a bunch of rule changes and that took place, which allowed for pension funds and insurance companies to go out and buy these things. Now, what was actually taking place there was an offloading of risk to the peasants. It was sold as a, oh, we're letting you in to the magic room. No, They were exiting, right, at valuations which were stupid for starters. Anyway, where this ties back into interest rates is that much of that private credit was financed at rates 300, 400, 500 basis points lower than today. And as those maturities of debt roll, then there's a repricing of risk, right, at 400 basis points or more higher. And so if you're running a big private credit fund, and you've got this pool of assets and you're getting a rollover on some of the debt on those assets and you're now having to pay a much higher coupon, you need equity. You need liquidity. You need either cash or equity to be able to say, hey, yeah, let's do the deal. They don't have the equity. So now you're forced to sell. You have to go and liquidate some assets in your portfolio to free up that equity. When they've come now to sell those assets, they're finding that they're not at par. They're not what they anticipated there were. In many instances, the equity tranche is completely wiped out and even the debt's impaired. And so this is why we have now hundreds of these funds that are all gated. And for your listeners who don't not be familiar with the term, gating simply says you can't get your money back. Hold off. So investors are seeing some of these write-downs and going, oh, give me my money back. When too many people do that, again, you have an illiquid asset. You don't have the ability to just pay your investors back, right? If you invested into, with me into this house, I mean, we bought the house, and you go, I want my money back tomorrow. I'm like, Tom, like, it's going to take us a while to sell this house, brother. Like, no. So I would gate you. I'd be like, no, you can't have your money back. You got to wait 6 months or whatever, and then we'll get what we get. So that's now taken place. But what's forcing the gating is the debt maturities rolling over. That's why interest rates matter. So the whole credit market is a massive bubble. It's basically blowing up while silently nobody even notices it. This is important because that paper was sold to insurance companies and to pension funds. Again, under the Trump administration, they said, you guys can have some of this. Again, they were offloading all the junk to the peasants. So now you have pension funds who are invested into the stuff and they don't even know it. In fact, I've spoken with some pension fund managers who don't even know what they bought, right? Because they're going down a tranche of capital allocation and they're often buying just structured vehicles. And this is a private credit, you know, high yield, blah, blah, blah fund. And they go, oh, cool, I'll buy that. I'll put that into my pension fund. Yeah, it yields 12%, fucking A. And so now that looks like a liquid vehicle until it's not, right? It's liquid because you can buy and sell it in this market until you can't, because when you dig into what it is, it's a locked up fund which has the ability to not redeem because, you know, so they all have these terms and conditions. Because they're holding illiquid assets, they have these terms and conditions which say, dear investor, you know, should conditions permit or require, you might not get your money out immediately sort of thing. And they've all got them. So that's what's taking place. So your pension funds are stacked with that sort of stuff. The other thing that they're stacked with is AI. So on the AI side of things, I mean, we've talked about this at length, but you have this scenario where we have, by every metric really, a situation of extreme overvaluation. And it's come about as a consequence of partly the passive capital trade. So the way that this works is, if you think about the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or any index funds or ETFs that are tied to it, they're all market cap weighted. Okay, so let's say you and I have got a 401k plan, which is what the Americans have. I'll just use America as an example now. So we put in, I don't know, $1,000 a month or whatever it is into our pension plan. That pension goes out and it just allocates into what's in the pension plan. Part of that allocation, increasing a large part, is say the S&P 500 and or the NASDAQ. So the $1,000 goes in. It buys more of the large cap equities than it does of the small cap. In other words, company number one, it buys more of that than it does of company number 500 in the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. And the more it buys it, it increases the market cap. So let's just say, for example, that 10% goes into the top one company. It's not that much, but just use this for ease of numbers. And 0.001% goes into company number 500. Okay. So now of that $1,000, we've got $100 goes into that. And you do the same thing. You've got another $100 that comes into that. That increases the market cap of that company more than it does of company number 500. Okay. So every addition, it's a feedback mechanism where it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Because the market cap gets bigger, it tells you to buy more of the thing that's bigger. Make sense? So mm-hmm. So this is where how we get to a situation where over 50% of the S&P 500 is concentrated in like 10 stocks. We've never had that level of concentration in the history of mankind before. And here we are. So with the AI CapEx spend, which is going vertical, that was mostly financed by equity, right? And now they're turning to debt. And they're turning to debt to finance the CapEx spend in large part because there is no revenue behind it. Okay, so like if you think about a normal business, you can self-finance your business. You just take some of your profitability and you put it back into the business. Like these things do not have the ability to do that because they don't make any money. Or they don't make any profits. So they've gone to the equity markets, and that's now tapered out to the extent now where they're going to the debt markets. And they're going to the debt markets at the same time, again, come back to what we began this conversation with, where interest rates are rising. So all of the debt that's being taken on now, and it's phenomenal, is going to it's going to have some maturity to it. And when that, if we're on the same trajectory that we're on now, when that matures, the interest rates are going to be much, much higher. Then the real question will be asked of, can this actually finance it with sustainable cash flows? And the answer, by even the people issuing the debt and the companies themselves, is a resounding no. A resounding no. They're saying that they're not going to be profitable for, and you can, like, they're all talking about different numbers, but they're years, if not decades out. And then we look at just the basics of the broad market, zoom back out into the broad market. And, you know, on every metric, US stocks are, they're like near 40 times earnings. In the dot-coms, they were just a little bit higher. It doesn't matter what metric we look at, whether it's the Shiller-Cape ratio, or PE values, whatever. We're at extremes. And so that's the other component there where people are heavily invested into and they don't even realize it. So you've got the private credit stuff and then you've got this, and then the component in one's portfolio that is meant to be safe and stable. Guess what that is? Bonds. And I'm like, you have it's stunning to me because I've never seen this before where you have the vast majority of people's pension funds is this. And, you know, in our asset management business, we'll sometimes have clients come to us. We see it all the time. And they go, oh, like, I want to invest in your fund. Fine. I've got this other fund. You mind having a look at it? Tell me what you think about it, because I'm going to transfer it over to you. We typically liquidate whatever that is, and then we build a portfolio. But we look at these things that they're owning. And I promise you, Tom, it's like across the board, doesn't matter what name they put on it. It's all the same thing. They're all invested into the same stuff. It's by and large the S&P. What so many fund managers have done over the years is they've just mirrored the S&P. They've made a few tweaks and changes around some percentage allocations, given it a different name, and typically charged another 200-300 basis points on top of it. And off they go, and they aggregate capital under that basis. It's like stunning to us. We keep seeing the same thing, and it doesn't matter if we've got clients coming in from South Africa and ones from Ohio and other ones from Tokyo. It's like they're by and large owning very, very similar structures. It's the same thing. Which actually, like, it does make sense. You know, I had a about a week and a half ago, I had a conversation with a large fund in and family office over in the Middle East, and then went down the path of trying to understand how these guys are positioned, not the particular individuals and their company, but the broad market of family offices and sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East. And you know what I found? That these guys have a massive, massive underallocation to they have a underallocation towards like commodities, emerging markets, things like China. I was interested in China because I've looked at China as this, we're seeing a lot of value in our dividend portfolio coming out of like Hong Kong equities. This is where it is. Like, we're not saying, oh, we want to own China. We're saying, oh, where's the value in the world and what does it look like? And so then I revert back and I look at these allocations, and these guys, along with most European and US fund managers, are about 70% allocated towards US equities. Massive, massive concentration. And so it's kind of just fascinating, because if you take, think about world economy. So the US economy is $29 trillion economy. Okay. Market cap of the US is it's about 70% US stocks market cap, and then you take China. China's a 20 trillion market cap, and it accounts for about 3% global market cap. So $20 trillion economy in China, about 3% market cap. $29 trillion in the US, about 70% market cap, right? And then you looked at the valuations. And so, like, this is how we're finding these really, really cheap valuations in a bunch of Hong Kong equities. I mean, the MSCI China index, I think it trades at a PE forward earnings of about 11. So it's interesting, because it just, even Chinese companies, even Middle Eastern companies, are all weighted into this AI bubble. Like, by allocating to the US, again, it goes into passive funds. The passive funds, we know they're all in the S&P 500. 50% of the S&P is like 10 companies, like massive, massive concentration, not just like from the US, but globally into that particular bucket. And then when we look at like the hyperscalers and the semiconductor industry, which is kind of two sides of the same coin, what's going on there is fascinating, because the semiconductor industry has done really well, obviously, right? Because they're buying chips like it's going out of fashion. But who's buying the chips? Well, these hyperscalers, and their free cash flow has collapsed. It's gone negative. So they don't have the money to buy it anymore. right? Mm-hmm. So now they, because the equity markets aren't prepared to finance it anymore. So now they're going to debt to the extent where that, the semiconductors are now financing the hyperscalers, saying, oh, you want to, we want you to keep buying our chips. It's great. Like, we love this. This is, game is so awesome. Oh, you're running out of money. Well, we've got a lot in treasury. How about we lend you money to keep buying our chips? Like, it's lending the neighbor next door who's got a drinking problem and no job money. Like, so how long this lasts for, I don't know, but structurally, this is a massive issue. And most people are invested into this stuff and they don't even sort of understand it or know it. And then, of course, we've got all the other things going on, whether it be the global conflict, the war in the Middle East, the restructuring of trade. And those are all issues which are supply constraint issues, and supply constraint brings inflation, and inflation brings higher cost of capital, and higher cost of capital is kryptonite towards growth equities.
And I was going to say, Chris, I mean, you know, one could argue that that environment of constantly falling interest rates that we have seen for the last 40, 45 years was, you know, an incredible place to build wealth, but that system only, you know, keeps on those rails if those interest rates are in place and keep falling, basically. And now if you take the, let's say, the recency bias out of it, and you actually structurally look at what is happening to the interest rate curves on, as you mentioned, all of these different countries, then you have to kind of evaluate that as the end of an era and perhaps a shift back to something like value investing, right?
Yeah, if you look at on a relative basis, because we could sort of talk about this stuff, and I guess I could be accused thus far of just talking about the negatives, right? But if you go and you say, okay, what doesn't fall into this specific space that does not have the same risk attributes to it, and on a relative basis is cheap, and we can look at the commodity index versus the Dow, the commodities versus the S&P, or more specifically the commodities versus the NASDAQ, and we're looking at structural lows, like sometimes 48-year lows. And so, I mean, I could show you the charts and this stuff, but it's just the charts itself scream to you that you're at such extreme levels. The other one, of course, is emerging markets. So just as I mentioned, you've got like roughly 70% of this global capital is all in the US. Well, if it's all there, where is it not? Well, it's not in emerging markets as a consequence. So you have commodities, you have emerging markets. China, I just mentioned, we've got a roughly 5% weighting into Chinese equities as a consequence of that. And so look, for me, investing is pure probability and then portfolio management, right? So you run probabilities and you go, I want the probabilities to be in my favor, and I want to have asymmetry. Asymmetry is both relatively low downside risk and relatively high upside reward. And then not be specific insofar as believing your own bullshit and saying, I'm going to put 50% of my weighting into that, right? You've got to have patience, both patience and probability, and then you structure a portfolio around those kinds of asset classes and those sectors. And so there is a lot of value out there. There is a lot of opportunity, but it's certainly not where the vast majority of people are looking. And people will look at this. I mean, I just mentioned China. So like people will be like, oh, but what about Taiwan? And what about it's the communists? And like all of this rhetoric, I'm not going to sit here and say wrong. No, like if that rhetoric has been in place for a long time, and it has, then it's priced, right? It's not that it's wrong. It's priced, and it's probably priced, overly priced, insofar as no one's going near it because they go, oh, China's going to take Taiwan and then there'll be World War III and we won't, whatever. maybe, but on probability, that's already priced, and it's priced beyond any reasonable valuation. We can see that because the valuations are unbelievably cheap. So now you go, well, it's just a position weighting decision. You know, is it 5% of your portfolio? Is it 2%? Is it 10? Like, that's a decision any individual needs to make on their own when constructing a portfolio. But that's the logical way to go about doing it, because you know what you're doing when you're saying, oh, that's a problem. The default often is like, well, I'm going to sit over here in what, Nvidia, right? So it's not that neither of them have risk. It's that they both have risk, but you need to evaluate the risk on a relative basis, and then run probability. And it's like, it's very obvious to us where one would allocate. So,
So, Chris, you know, many of these changes are, again, very kind of very structural, but very slow moving until it kind of happens. You know, one of the things that kind of stood out to me, and I'm sure you saw it a bunch this week too, was this clip of J.D. Vance, for example, talking about wanting to end the U.S.'s position as the reserve currency because, as he put it, it allowed Americans to consume too much and to do so too cheaply. So what do you think marks the end of the U.S. dollar as being used as a reserve currency? And what does that end up looking like for the U.S.? Does it become more like Japan, where you're constantly playing a seesaw sacrifice between the currency and the bond market?
I don't think, Tom, there's any realistic alternative at this point to the dollar. And I say that because we're still running a credit-based system. And the reality is that the counterparties to almost every trade globally, the counterparty is the dollar. And so unwinding that, and it's in process, unwinding that is still a very volatile and uncomfortable process. What your question sort of, what predates your question to some degree, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's a political question, right? So where people are saying, oh, well, the dollar is this reserve currency, which is true, and the US wants to maintain that dollar-based system, and That's based on the idea that the politicians that are ostensibly in power, and I say ostensibly because they're not, they're middle management, have that desire. When you understand how the flows of capital work, and then you will figure out who's actually in power, or and who, what their incentives are. So very quickly on that basis, the Western democratic world, if you will, is neither democratic. It's definitely not. It is run by corporate interests largely. So, and you can just see this in terms of funding, right? So, you know, who funded Vance? How did Vance get to the position that he's in? And that's very clear. He got funded by Peter Thiel. And then you go, okay, so Peter Thiel has, he's paid, Vance is paid by Peter Thiel to be there. So what is Peter Thiel's objectives and desires? And then you look at Trump and you go, well, who funded Trump, and why is he there? Who paid him? And it's quite easy. It's like you look at, it's the Saudis, it's Miriam Adelson, which is your Zionists, and it's Elon Musk, and it's your technocrats. Okay, so that's who he works for. It's not a, there, when you look at it like that, then everything that's happened in his administration makes perfect sense, right? It doesn't matter if he said, oh, I'm going to release the Epstein files, and I'm going to stop the wars, and like, he, so a politician's value lies in their ability to convince the public and be elected. That's the value to the people who pay that politician. is the politician's ability to lie convincingly to the public in order to get into power. But when they're in power, they answer to their employer, right? The employer employed them to be able to lie sufficiently to get into power so that they can execute the desires of the big boss, of the employer. And there's a number of them, so there are some competing interests there. But that's how it works. So this idea of democracy is nonsense. It's nonsense for any thinking man, because all that one needs to do is look at what is stated and what are the actions that have taken place as a consequence. And they're so widely divergent that you have to realize that whatever they're stating is nonsense. And then you say, why are they stating nonsense? And what are they doing, and why, and who benefits from the things that they are doing? So back to the dollar-based system, those individuals, right, whether it be, there's another group in there. Well, on Trump's side, I'm trying to think of the corporate entity that that funded him, which is part. There's Miriam Adelson. There's another group, and that group is basically military. Which Adelson's also very tied into that, and so your Northrop Grumman's, your BA Systems. So they need, like, for them, it benefits to have war, right? Do they care about the dollar-based system? Not especially. Do the Saudis care about a dollar-based system? Not especially, right? And so the dollar-based system has been a useful tool, right, to have the world operate under the U.S. Dominance. But it's not specific to the individuals that are financing this now. They don't necessarily care, and I think they can see the writing on the wall. What they simply want is more power and more influence. And where the dollar-based system goes away, the dollar-based system is people need to think about that as a military control as opposed to a financial transmission system. It's both, but where that financial transmission takes place, there's the military control that comes behind it, which we've seen this with the use of sanctions, removing certain entities from SWIFT, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a militarization of that financial infrastructure, okay? The two go hand in hand. So it's been very useful in that respect. But we know that that's waning. The ability to continue to wield that weapon is waning. And so this is where now it actually makes sense why you have such a massive build out of data centers and what is a financial surveillance state infrastructure. So you've got Palantir, you've got all these data centers. That and flock cameras and all of this sort of surveillance infrastructure. Why are they rushing to get that developed? Well, they're rushing to get it developed because they want to implement that, if possibly, globally, because that will replace the dollar-based system. The dollar-based system acts because of the military prowess behind it, right? Since like 1945. Okay, you had the US and its Navy controlled the oceans, so therefore it controlled trade, and therefore it could implement the dollar, the trade utilizing the dollar, whether it's oil, copper, gold, traded in dollars. They've got the military, they had the Navy to say, do as you're told, fine. Okay, they're realizing that ability to do that is waning, right? The US Navy, Chinese Navy is now larger than the US Navy. And by almost every metric, the Chinese have already won. Certainly if you look at purchasing power parity and not GDP, which is a bullshit scenario anyway. But I digress. So that dollar-based system, if you view it from a military perspective, right, it was the military that allowed that to actually exist. The military aspect now is under massive pressure, and they realize that. So they say, well, we need another system. That other system is central bank digital currencies. It's surveillance state systems. It's a control of the communications, internet, and financial infrastructure. If you can control all of that via technology, their hope is that the military, the Navy, for example, is not... the loss of that power can be supplanted to some degree, while at the same time just making sure that they control the geopolitical choke points. This is why they went into the Strait of Hormuz. It's a geopolitical choke point. It's why Israel is threatening Turkey. Why? Because of the Bosphorus. Because the Bosphorus is that geopolitical choke point that cuts off or controls Europe, and hence Russia, because it has Russia's only warm water port. And then this is also why we're seeing an invasion into Ceuta in Spain. Why? Because you have the Strait of Gibraltar, another geopolitical choke point. The other one, of course, is Panama. So those are all being fought over. They want to secure those at the same time that they're running this digital surveillance state infrastructure, building it as fast as they fucking can, before the markets take away their ability to do so. And the markets are going to take away their ability to do so when the bonds crack. That's why they're scrambling over in Japan, trying to hold up the yen. That's why Besant is spending so much money holding up the yen. And it's not because he cares about the yen. It's because he cannot have Japan selling treasuries into a market where they have massive issuance required to finance all this stuff. So they cannot have bond yields going up. So they, and Japan is the largest sovereign owner of US sovereign debt. And so they like, no, you can't sell treasuries. And they're like, yeah, but you guys had a war and you've caused the cost of energy to rise, and we're net importers of energy and we need energy. So the US has kind of shot their banker in the foot, and they're trying to hold that together while building out all of this other stuff.
So, Chris, why do you think that this has kind of moved from, you know, a lot of covert action to basically being overt action? Does it show in a way like the desperation of this system at this point?
So if we go back, Tom, to the topic of who controls what, okay, that is becoming more overt, you know. So it's becoming increasingly evident to much of the world that the politicians in power are not making the decisions, right? There's been the revealing of AIPAC and their influence in US politics. There's been the reveals of what COVID was and why it was put in place. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge distrust. The ability for, and these things have been going on for a long time. They just weren't known. They weren't known because the media, largely owned and controlled by these interests, had the ability to gaslight the public. The more one gets gaslighted and the more one realizes that you've been lied to, there's a retention. So people have been pulling back from mainstream media. We can see the numbers all been collapsing in mainstream media, even where they just keep going. So like Israel just went and bought TikTok, right, to try and clamp down on that and control that. But things just move on to other platforms. And the point is that there is certainly in mainstream media. Now, TikTok is kind of your not media necessarily, not in the traditional sense. And this is why we're seeing this move towards controlling social media more and more. But the point is that they're losing control of the ability to gaslight, which reveals and then they're desperate to move things forward or to retain things in place. And as a consequence, they have to become more overt. You know, we were talking earlier the Daily Wire and that little squeaky voice, Ben Shapiro guy. So like, he's a perfect example of an unprofitable, but by and large an unprofitable business that's just received another $100 million. But it's not this, so, and you go, well, why would anybody invest $100 million? It's because the investment doesn't pay off in terms of traditional profitability or the company makes money. That's not what it's designed to do. It's a propaganda channel designed to influence a certain class of voting class within the US towards certain objectives and desires. But the ability for them to run that operation, like in the past, that could run as a profitable enterprise. As more and more people, you know, go, no, I don't want it. Just, you know, it's just supply and demand. So your customer base is eroding. And so it becomes less profitable. That's why the ability to keep Covert in place is collapsing, because it's not profitable. It's too expensive to run Covert operations, right? So you could be running Covert operations, as has been the case through mainstream media, to the extent where people were paying to be lied to, okay? Increasingly, they're going, I don't want to be lied to, so I'm not going to pay you. So your revenue model changes because it's no longer profitable to keep that enterprise running. So now you have to fund it to try and keep what's in place. That's why they're funding Ben Shapiro's thing. Not profitable, but they're funding it because they're kind of trying to keep it in place. But that desperation leads them to becoming more overt. So there's a feedback loop there. And also where people realize, oh, like, this is what it is. Oh, I don't, you know. And so there's that. And then I think also to a large degree, there's a hubris that, and an arrogance that comes with it, where, you know, as things get revealed, there's no consequences. They go, oh, shit, we've been gaslighting these people for so long. Like, why did we bother? We could have just told them that we're out to fucking kill them. And, like, what are they going to do? And we're seeing kind of more of that, where they're just very overt about what they're doing. And I think to some degree it's even been a testing, you know, like the Epstein release, that was a test. Oh, well, like, we'll drip feed this. And people go, oh, wow, they're eating babies. Like, so think about this, Tom. We now know conclusively that a bunch of Hollywood elites, people who still walk the streets, are pedophiles, named, listed pedophiles within the Epstein files, that they conducted and performed rituals of sacrifice, human sacrifice, ate babies. Like, what in what world can they reveal this? And these people still walk the streets and no one does anything to them, right? So they kept drip feeding it and no one does anything.
We've had that discussion before, talking about the age of unaccountability, right?
Yeah. So that's like, there's that combination where they go, oh, maybe we don't need to be covert anymore. Like, if they know what we're doing and they do nothing to us, like, what's stopping us doing whatever we want to do? The answer's nothing. So that's the situation we're moving into. And again, those individuals don't really have, they don't care one way or the other whether there's a dollar-based system necessarily. They've got much more their own narrow interests, whether it's Palantir or whether it's Northrop Grumman or like any of these, like their desire is just to keep making money. And for the average person, I guess they find it difficult to reconcile this because of how they've been gaslighted. Do you think about the Afghanistan war? And I see it every now and then. People are like, oh my gosh, we lost $1 trillion in Afghanistan and then they had to leave. It's like, no. That it wasn't like they don't care that you socialize the losses. The peasants paid for the trillion. And And the whole mechanism was in place to keep sending money to the military industrial complex, and it worked fantastically, right? It worked amazingly, and they started off with a Taliban led government that didn't allow opium. And they went in there, they took all the opium trade. This is how the Mossad and CIA financed their operations. And look, it's no different to what the Brits did when in the Opium Wars. It's the same story. And then they replace it now with a government that is okay with opium, so they can remain in power. But so the entire operation was never about defeating the Taliban. It was about making sure that you had a flow of capital from the socialized markets, which is to say the government, which is to say they can blow out deficits, tax the shit out of people, because the deficits don't matter to these people, right? It's the working class that's going to pay for that via inflation. And when they ultimately monetize that debt, they'll be fine. So the design was never about that. And people struggle to see that because they'll look at it from a point of view where they think that the design is for the nation state to exist and to benefit. And it's like, oh, America's benefiting. No, companies and individuals benefit, and it's a socialization of the expenses. That's what you're going through. That's what we're doing right now. You know, we're just sending money to Ukraine and to the Middle East. That's just simply benefiting the military and financial industrial complex. And you're socializing the losses. They realize the losses are expanding, and they're going to keep doing it until the bond market takes away their ability to do so. And then what will they do? They'll monetize the debt. They'll print the shit out of the money, and then that's going to wipe out the working and the middle class, and even many wealthy people who don't get out of the way of it. But they understand that. They don't, like, it's not a problem to them.
Well, it's interesting as you're explaining all of this. I'm just envisioning this, company and or country that has something to sell, and it doesn't matter to them whether it's US dollars or Chinese yen or sorry, yuan, sorry. As long as they have something to sell, they don't really care what the denomination is that they're paid
Not really.
in. And
It's about
that applies to the whether it's the military industrial complex or a country like you explained, like Saudi Arabia with lots of energy, right?
So the dollar, like the dollar system, was useful because it was a captured system that forced people into that system, and it was like you're basically paying tributes to it. So the bankers, the financial world benefited significantly from that. But they also realized that they've kind of pushed the end of that envelope, which is why they're looking to replace it with another system. And their hope, and you look at Larry Fink and all of these guys, again, look at who the funders are, look at who the middle management are. Those are the people, what they're building, what they want. Cantor Fitzgerald, Tether, all of this stuff. That's the new financial infrastructure that they're trying to build. They know that this other world's going away, and they're like, fine, we'll just torch it. Like, we'll napalm that sucker when we need to, but we're scrambling to get this other system built and then bring people into that system. So if you think about the dollar credit system, it's a control system, right? You kind of have to have dollars to buy copper, lead, da 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 da. That system's going away. They want a tokenized world where all of these assets are tokenized, and they've BlackRock and the likes of BlackRock have control over that system, and they will just extract from that system. But you'll be tied into that financial infrastructure system. That's what they want. That's what they're building. And this isn't me trying to, like, this is just me looking at what is being built, what has been built, and where the incentives lie. And it's
What are their
very clear.
actions?
It's just deductive reasoning. That's what we're in. So the whole idea of, oh, the dollar's going to die, and like people are rabbiting on about the death of the dollar, like they completely missed the point. It's these people don't care about the dollar. They care about power and influence and the mechanisms to do that. The dollar has been, and the credit system in particular, has been a mechanism for them to extract. And it's reaching and has potentially reached the end of its lifespan. They understand that 100%, and they've been building for years the replacement, and they're pushing that through. In fact, the collapse of the dollar is what they will need. It's what they will use to justify the new system that they roll out. Mm-hmm. And people, so Chris, will flock to it.
People will what? Sorry?
People will flock to it because the default will be the system that they are in process of demolishing.
So Chris, how does energy constrain a lot of these different players within the world right now? You know, we look at certain countries like, let's say, the US, but I think a better example right now is Russia, somebody that was exporting energy and has now gotten to the point that we have, or so much of their infrastructure has been destroyed by Ukraine that they've now stopped exporting diesel. Diesel crack spreads have basically exploded to some of the highest spreads we've ever seen. So how does that get priced into the economy?
It's not currently being priced, as far as I can tell. So the real crisis is in distillates and in refined products, to the extent that we actually almost have a quote-unquote surplus of oil. We don't have a surplus of oil on a traditional basis. In other words, if all the refineries were still refining product, we would have a shortage of oil. But because you've had a destruction of the refining capacity that is exceeds the destruction of flow of oil, then there's a spread between the two. That's your crack spread. And the crack spread, for those of you listening, is just simply the difference between feedstock prices, which is crude oil and Brent and the various, there's lots of actually different types of oil, but just call it oil, and your refined end product. And that's because the capacity to take the feedstock and turn it into something that's useful has been damaged. So whether it be Russian refineries that have been bombed by the West, whether it be Gulf state refineries that have been bombed, heck, we've had a whole lot of, you know, subsequent fires. Australia had a couple of refineries taken out. And so you can put your tinfoil hat on there as to how and why that took place. But we've had massive reduction in refining capacity. And so this is where the crisis is going to be in distillates and in end product, specifically diesel, because the world runs on diesel. All your heavy machinery runs on diesel. And again, I think this is probably by design, because you're forcing people into a scenario whereby you will have the ability to ration and control a society based on the narrative that it was the dirty Iranians or the whatever, the bad Russians or something. And this is why we now have a shortage of diesel. But we have to, you know, it'll be COVID 2.0, you know, protect the weak, some sort of bullshit. And that will determine who gets the diesel. And lo and behold, it'll likely be your Amazon, Walmart. You know, they will be critical, as opposed to the local butcher down the road who won't be critical, and he might not get any diesel, and so on and so forth. But to the point of energy, the thing that has always existed with financialization of products is taking an underlying valuable item and then essentially leveraging that item. And you can do it via, you know, derivative contracts and loan obligations and whatever, right? That's just like that's always been the case. And the greater that the leverage that sits on top of that underlying item, it creates more, ultimately it creates more risk. In the early phases, it can dampen volatility, which is how futures markets first came about. And then in the late stages of it, it lands up creating more volatility. So if you come all the way back to the situation that we're in today, much of the valuable items in the world that cannot be that cannot be created by financialization, so to speak. So like, you know, you and I could sit down and we could create a credit firm and we could leverage items and like just fuck around with things like that. Much more difficult would be for us to go and find oil and dig an oil well and put drill rigs down and like actually like create something of value, or go and like buy a farm and farm that farm for beef cattle or wheat or whatever the case might be. Those underlying items on a relative basis across the world are the cheapest that they've ever been. If we look at our hard assets, oil relative to, you know, certainly if you take oil prices relative to the NASDAQ, I mean, energy companies within the S&P, there's that about 33% allocation. Like it's one of the lowest in history. While we have massive supply destruction, okay, that should be, for any thinking human being, should be like, maybe I should have some allocation towards that because there's asymmetry there. So, you know, that's basically where we're increasingly, or not increasingly, we have been positioned for some time, but it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, Tom. Food, shelter, energy, all of the derivative products and the credit instruments, whether they be on blockchain or whether they be through some traditional metric, none of that should, like that will always exist to some degree. There are stages in the cycle where you simply want to own the direct asset, the underlying hard asset, the one that cannot be created by the stroke of a administerial pen or by the issuance of some piece of paper from a Wall Street entity.
As Doomberg likes to say, the molecules that can't just be, printed.
Correct. Can't print molecules, can't print kilojoules. And the debt that we have is going to have to get monetized. The monetization of that, like it's possible we get into a situation where the price doesn't matter because the denominator is being so trashed. You know, so like people will sit there. I got asked this question the other day, and they're like, "Oh, you know, what's your price for, say, gold?" I'm like, you can't have a price for gold or oil or anything when the denominator can be destroyed or inflated at will. Like, I don't know to what degree that can be inflated. And if you look at historically, they can inflate it away to nothing. So then, like, it could be 5,000, 10,000, 150,000. Like, it doesn't matter. So I don't have price targets on this stuff. I think it's a meaningless exercise.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to think about kind of the ways that we've seen, especially recently, the effort to calm people about the idea that molecules are there. For example, Rand Paul's latest visit to Fort Knox to say the gold is there. What do you think that exercise was about? Because anybody that is actually worried about that, that is thinking about that, isn't taking somebody's word for it that it's there, that, you know, looked in one room and saw it.
It's just, I guess, Tom, all this stuff comes back to, like, what is it that you're going to do about it, right? Like, there's so many things that we could talk about which are, they're useful. They're useful insofar as understanding a problem. And then there's a requirement, and we talked about this at the start before we started hitting record, you know, where I think it's there's a lot of humanity at the moment that simply doesn't want to incur any discomfort. And so they shy away from anything that's uncomfortable. And that leads all the way down to the point where if you look at something that makes you uncomfortable, the reason that it makes you uncomfortable is because as a man, you look, you know, when you feel uncomfortable, you go, I need to do something about that. And if that's something that you do entails hardship or discomfort, then that's what you should do. It doesn't matter what you feel about it. Right? Feelings don't matter, which is unfortunately we just have a very feminized society. But, you know, what do we do about it? Well, from a financial perspective, it's like I said earlier, it's pretty clear as to where one should be allocated. You stay very far away from risk. Those risks have highlighted what they are. And then you simply allocate towards the areas that are that have asymmetry. And incidentally, there are to the point that you made, which Bloomberg made, sorry, Doomberg made, molecules can't be printed, kilojoules can't be printed. And then on a relative basis, they're the cheapest that they've been in you know, decades in many instances. So, I mean, you can get further down the line of how do you hold those assets and in what structures, and that's a it's a topic for another day, but it's addressing an issue. It's like you can't ignore the issue. Well, you can ignore the issue. What's it, what Ayn Rand said? You know, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that goes back to a point that you've made before as well. The idea of ownership. What do you actually own? And what are you actually just a subscriber of, right? If you have a car, if you have a car or a phone or a bank account that can be shut off at somebody else's will, because exactly, you don't own it. And that goes for your assets. And it's uncomfortable to think about, to take action on, but you're in many cases, you're not ever going to be worse off for taking action on it.
No, and like the other thing with taking action is that you start training yourself, right, to actually taking action. And it's like how do you build a brick wall? Well, one brick at a time. Do you know what I mean? And so most people at the moment, I find that they look at something and they go, it's a brick wall. Like, that's a big, I'm not a bricklayer. It's like, You just start one brick at a time, and you take one step at a time. When you see risks and those issues, you address them where you can, and some of them you might not be able to address them right here and now. And you go, okay, I understand. I'm going to file it away. It's a risk. I can't address the risk, but like not being able to address a risk and refusing to address a risk are not the same thing, and that's the critical thing. And so, if you look through history, the vast like where there's been massive crises, it's like 5%, sometimes less, of the population who escape that. And you look at it, and like over history, we'll look back and we'll go, oh my God, that was so obvious. The, you know, and it is so obvious, right? And now we're sitting in it right now. And I'm finding people that are like, well, I don't really like it. I'm like, whether you like it or not, like feelings don't matter. It doesn't matter what you feel about it. It's irrelevant, right? And so it is what it is. Then that forces you into what are you going to do about it? And not doing something about it is a decision in itself. And that's fine. But then you've got to be like, take that ownership and be like, I've decided I'm going to not do something about this. And I'm just going to face the consequences. Fine, like that's okay, but pretending it doesn't exist and pretending there aren't consequences is where most people lie and they land. And you know, we talked about this before we hit record, and I had experiences seeing the same thing transpire in Zimbabwe, and you know, studying like Cambodia's history, and like the signs are so clear and all of these, and then like 95% of the population just got totally screwed. And you're like, what was wrong with them? Like, how did they not like there must, you sort of think there must have been a point where they realized this is a problem. And for like, obviously there's not, because the stats show it, right? I suppose for many, the like when they really, really realized it was when they're there and that's like game over. but yeah, it's the ability for human beings to discount the obvious that is uncomfortable is quite astounding. What's that saying, that man will prefer the comfortable lie to the uncomfortable truth?
Mm-hmm. Reminds me of another, I guess, kind of saying that a person's success can be a person's success in life can be directly attributed to their ability to make hard decisions or have hard conversations.
Yeah. Very good. I concur.
Well, Chris, I think that's a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. I'm sure we've left our listeners with a lot to think about. Is there anything that you'd like to leave them with before we wrap up here?
No, I think we've covered enough today. Appreciate your time. It's always good to chat.
Absolutely, Chris. Couldn't agree with that sentiment more. Of course, you're available on X at CapitalistEXP, CapitalistExploits.com, and of course, CapitalistExploits on Substack as well. Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.